This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This hour, we begin a tour of America's suddenly changing voting booths as the new reality for voting rights encourages localities to make changes that would have been impossible before the recent Supreme Court decision. And later this hour, kids home from camp missing their smartphones more than their parents, a troubling but perhaps not surprising sign of our age. But first, we could soon be looking at an Egypt where one toppled dictator is freed from prison while a deposed elected leader is under arrest. The tale of Egyptian leaders Hosni Mubarak and Mohamed Morsi takes another turn. We learned today that the Egyptian judiciary is well along in a process that may clear Hosni Mubarak of corruption charges and set him free within 48 hours. This, as the number of dead in Egypt in a week of violent confrontations is more than 1,000 now, with thousands more injured. And within the last 24 hours, a police convoy was targeted by militants in the northern Sinai Desert, more than two dozen police killed. This seems to be all-out war between the military and the Islamists. Is it a moment to isolate Egypt or a moment to come to the aid of Egyptian civilians, the government, or the Islamists? Governments throughout the world are considering their options. Today, ambassadors from the European Union meet. Gulf states have already pledged their support for the regime in Cairo. The United States has condemned the violence, and while it continues to maintain a more than billion-dollar aid package to Egypt, the longer this goes on, the more difficult that will be. But the Egyptians seem fully able to continue their internal attempt to quell violence between the military and Islamist forces without relying on any other nation's backing. Charles Sennett is the vice president and editor-at-large of Global Post. He reported on the 2011 revolution in Cairo and the Arab Spring, and he's done reporting on the current situation as well. He joins us now. Welcome, Charles.
Thanks, John. Good to be with you.
Give me a sense of the contrasts of that was then, this is now. You've had firsthand experience.
Well, right now, I mean, Egypt really feels unhinged in a way I've never seen it. I've been covering the country for 20 years. There was an Islamist insurgency that then President Hosni Mubarak cracked down on, and there was the revolution in Tahrir Square. And now there's this moment where Egyptians are faced with this really terrible choice between military dictatorship and a return to that, which is what it feels like to many Egyptians right now, or some kind of Islamist theocracy. And I can tell you, this is not what those millions who gathered in Tahrir Square wanted, was that kind of choice. They don't feel that their revolution has yielded democracy. And the United States foreign policy, I mean, it is in an incredible bind. Do you support stability or democracy?
It seems like there's a third choice here, although no one's really making it explicitly, and that is the sort of Lebanon-Syria open-ended chaos choice that's neither democratic nor dictatorial.
I fear you're right. You know, the problem is there are so many ways to prevent it from descending into that, and it's going to take more attention to detail than the State Department has given it. I recognize it's an enormous challenge for the United States government, but it's also something where they really need to step up, get more in the game, and listen more carefully to the music of the streets that are happening right now in Egypt. Right now, it just sounds like gunfire, tear gas, incredible violence, and an explosion of emotion. But they've got to get back to listening to that core. And, you know, you pointed out a third choice, which is war. There's another choice, which is to get back to the goals of the revolution, which is a democratically elected government.
It's all symbolic at this point. I mean, just describe for me the symbolic value or intensity of having Hosni Mubarak free and Mohamed Morsi in custody, if that's what happens this week.
It's a stunning irony of the post-revolutionary Egypt that you have Hosni Mubarak, certainly not completely free, but able to at least meet with his family. And you have the elected president, the first democratically elected president of Egypt in 5,000 years of history, is now in an undisclosed location under arrest. He was elected by voters in a free and fair election. And, you know, the fact that he did a pretty terrible job governing is clear to everyone. That was expressed by 20 million people on the streets. But I think the vast majority of the people on that street didn't want to see a military coup. And, you know, you have this situation, again, where there's this binary choice between military coup and Islamist theocracy. And there are better choices than that. And the United States government, if it's going to be effective in diplomacy and it's going to understand the importance of Egypt in the region, is going to have to help shape some other future path than just those two choices.
Talking with Charlie Sennett, Vice President and Editor-at-Large of Global Post. You're a student of history, someone who really loves to take the long view. I'm wondering, looking back to 1914 and the extent to which the instability in the Balkans produced a conflagration that we call today World War I, do you see this as isolated in Egypt, as isolated in the region? Has the Middle East become the Balkans of our century?
I don't think so. I think we live in a different time when the machinery of war operates very differently, and I think it operates much more locally. You have a situation in Egypt where, very interestingly, as you point out, all those lines of 1914 that created those countries that we now call the modern Middle East, they were false lines on a map that were drawn in the aftermath of World War I. And if you really look at those lines, they are disintegrating. They're washing away. They're shifting. They're changing. And that is one of the realities of the Arab Spring. And that said, I would also say every country inside the Arab Spring has its own individual reality. It's very hard to apply a lot of regional trends or sort of broad understandings. Egypt is Egypt. Egypt is a very important American ally. It's the most populous nation in the Arab world. It borders Israel. It is extraordinarily important. And I'm continually stunned at how the direction of events keeps going in the wrong direction. It's like watching a car accident in slow motion. And everything you don't want to happen keeps happening. I think at some point we're going to have to be much more effective from a U.S. perspective in our diplomacy. I mean, one of the great realities is we are really ineffective on the streets right now. The only thing that binds both sides of this deeply divided country in Egypt is that they both think the U.S. policy is a failure. You know, they say in journalism, if both sides don't like what you're doing, maybe you've actually done your job. I don't think that's true in diplomacy.
An argument for all nations to either take sides in the Egyptian conflict or to keep hands off. Every nation has to really consider its options. Charlie Sennett, Vice President and Editor-at-Large of Global Post, reported on the 2011 revolution in Cairo and the Arab Spring and the events of the last month. Charlie, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
And now, your government and your privacy. Accidents will happen? Well, a government agency with a record of thousands of privacy lapses. Is this a Fourth Amendment disaster or a sign that in the era of big data, a mere thousand errors is actually an exemplary record of oversight on unauthorized domestic surveillance? A report last week from the Washington Post, based on the classified documents from now Russian-based leaker Edward Snowden, goes beyond the mere idea of what the NSA is electronically capable of, which was alarming or powerful enough, depending on what you think about the government's approach to global terrorism, to something else. These latest revelations show a pattern of lapses or even disregard for the constitutional rules set up to oversee this staggering NSA capability to monitor. Bart Gellman, who reported this story for The Washington Post, joins us now. Mr. Gellman, welcome to The Takeaway.
Pleasure to be here.
So do you see this as 2,000 or so smoking guns on the part of the NSA, or 2,000 in a billion-dollar sort of data set is nothing?
It really depends how you look at it, whether you're interested in the proportion or the absolute number. You know, if they have a billion air passengers every year, for instance, if they only lose your luggage 1% of the time, what is that, 10 million? It seems like a fairly large number to you, and it's going to bother you a lot if your luggage is lost.
The thing that's really disturbing about your story, though, is that even when there are programs in place, specific oversight patterns in place, there seems to be a sense that the NSA sometimes tries to cover up what it's done, or even when it knows what's happening, doesn't really change things on a timely basis.
Well, look, like any big organization, especially any big secret organization, it's not especially interested in having anybody else in its business. And it was eyebrow-raising, at least to say that when they made a big mistake some years ago and started listening or actually intercepting call data records from Washington instead of from Egypt because they confused the area code 202 with the country code 20, they did not consider that a reportable infraction that anybody had to know.
And that's just because it's a typographical error, and therefore on their own, by their own investigation, there's no intent there, so therefore nobody needs to know about it?
Well, a little bit. I mean, they report lots of typographical errors, and this was actually an interaction between several different sort of automated systems that misunderstood each other. Nevertheless, it fell between the cracks of their required reports. They have a number of authorities under several different laws. They have masters elsewhere in the executive branch, in the judiciary, and in Congress, and each has very specific requirements, and they didn't feel like this one met any of them.
Just, you know, without prejudging here, is this your sense that the NSA is incapable of following the rules of the FISA courts, or that the FISA courts are simply not scaled to deal with what the NSA's capability is?
Well, I think it's much more the latter. There are only two instances in the history of the FISA court when a judge has made an on-the-record statement to a reporter. Both of them were to my colleague Carol Lettig, and the most recent was the chief judge, Reggie Walton, who told her that the court simply doesn't have either the resources or the mission independently to verify what the NSA tells it. If the government reports an infraction, the court will ask questions and try to get to the bottom of it and demand a fix. But it depends on the government itself to come report an infraction.
So the oversight systems on this NSA capability are simply symbolic, that the way that the structure of big data and electronic surveillance is right now, it's got to be the NSA that does the reporting. It's got to be the NSA that does its own oversight. And the FISA courts are a kind of a nice hood ornament on a much bigger vehicle here.
Look, I think the main significance of the story for me is that the many layers of safeguards and checks and balances and oversight and rigorous review that have been described so often by the government on the NSA are not nearly all those things. They're simply not capable of managing the behavior of an organization this large and this powerful. I mean, the intelligence committees in Congress have less than a handful of staffers who work full-time on managing the NSA, which has tens of thousands of employees and, you know, over $10 billion budget, and operations of a sort of technological and operational complexity that sort of boggles the mind. It is simply not the case that there is any external organization that has the NSA under a looking glass.
Indeed. Well, it, on paper, it looks like oversight, but it may be autonomy in actual practice, according to Barton Gellman, a contributor to The Washington Post. Thanks so much, Bart.
Thank you.
Ah, yes, this is the moment. Summer winding down, and the camps of summer open their gates for parents to pick up weary, wide-eyed, sunburned kids clutching bags of homebound dirty laundry, but none of their technology, laptops, cell phones, and tablets. Full of low-tech adventure stories to tell, though, these campers. We had one of those reunions with my 12-year-old son, Zach, yesterday. At the Beam Camp for Boys and Girls in Stratford, New Hampshire, younger brother Ajax wanted to be the first to hug his big brother. Squeals and hugs all over America, the home from camp reunion. Mom, I missed you. Now, can I have my cell phone back? The longing for technology may have supplanted the longing to be in one's own bed, eat mom's cooking, and other elements of traditional homesickness. But a summer camp in rural Pennsylvania decided to investigate this a bit. They let all campers use any technology they want, but first the kids had to give it up cold turkey for a time. Manush Zamarodi observed all of this with intense interest and I suspect a little bemusement. Manush is the host of WNYC's New Tech City. Tell me a little bit about this camp and welcome.
Well, you know, thank you, first of all. It's great to be back. This camp was very special because it's a camp that was in a family, the Smith family, for four decades. And this was the first summer that Matt Smith, the young son, he's 31, he took the camp over and he decided that he felt like they weren't really helping out the teenagers figure out where technology fits in their lives. To take it away for the summer and then just give it back, he thought really wasn't promoting coping skills. So his idea was, bring all your gadgets, as you said, but we're going to take them away for the first week, and then we are going to give them back to you. And, you know, when I went up to visit them, one of the teenagers had such a, they were so thoughtful, these teenagers. One of them really described normally how teenagers cope when they feel uncomfortable in a situation.
Lots of people just go into themselves with their technology because, you know, people don't see technology as tools anymore. They see them as, like, friends. So it's like instead of spending time with, like, people friends, they're spending time with their iPhone, which is their friend.
kids think of them not simply as friends, as sometimes bodily organs. I mean, it's very, very difficult to detach. What was that like for these kids?
It did not feel good. I think they came with their gadgets, and Matt Smith, you know, this lovely, lovely guy who's not that far from how old they are. They're 17, 16. They handed them over, and I think they felt like something had been Velcroed out of their brain, just ripped off. Here's how one girl, Morgan, described it.
The first week, it was really hard because as soon as you walk up, they take your phone for the week. And I was like, oh, my God.
And I think that these are kids who are so used to being in constant contact, not only with their friends, but with their parents. So this was really about getting completely away, and they weren't quite ready for it.
Well, these are kids. I mean, I've been living this summer, totally. You know, one kid goes to summer camp. Other kids sort of go away for, you know, sleepaways, this sort of thing. All issues revolve around when I get the phone, when do I take the phone, mm-hmm. is it charged, do you have the charger, all sorts of things like that. It occurs to me that this 31-year-old camp director is actually a couple of generations away from these teens, as young as he is, in terms of the technological iterations that have already happened. When you begin to give the tech back to the kids, do they suddenly, you know, does the blood return to their face, the color? What is it?
All hell broke loose, John. Absolutely all hell
really?
Broke loose. The way Matt described it was all the beautiful friendships and lovely atmosphere that had been created in that first week was completely gone. Kimmy, this was a girl from Long Island, said that she was thrilled to get her tech back, but she was also kind of freaked out by what happened to her.
It was weird. I didn't even realize that 20 minutes had went by. I was sitting on my phone. I know this sounds so strange, but I didn't even know where I was in like a weird way, because I was like, wait, am I talking to my friends or am I at camp?
So it was like an out-of-body experience for them. But I will say that that was pretty much the first day when everybody completely got back in touch with their friends. They started watching games, playing videos, whatever else they were doing. But then things started to shake down and they started to come back to life and say, oh, yeah, I kind of liked how things were that first week. Being with my friends, reading a book. And so they started to put limitations on themselves.
Well, let's talk for just a second about what this means in terms of the kinds of research you've done. You've reported on this a lot. I mean, what's going on in the brain? Sense of place, sense of time, sense of identity, all confused by tech. Suddenly in the camp where you have the camp identity and your text and friends and playlist identity, these things are colliding and then merging at the same time in this camp?
Yes, and I think two things, right? Matt said that first week his campers were much less anxious, just in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what it was, this having to be different people for different wherever you are. If you're on Twitter, you're one person. If you're on Facebook, you're another. If you're texting with your parents, you're another person. If you're at Camp Circle, then you're another person. Like you said, it's kind of discombobulating. But the other thing was, is I think that the kids really were given a chance without peer pressure, without anybody saying, here's how you should be with your gadgets. They started to figure out for themselves. So when kids were wearing headphones all the time, they would give them really dirty looks. Some kids were saying, you know what, I'm only using it during free period. And that is it.
Did this change the way kids relate to their gadgets in the end?
I would say yes. For the majority of them, it did. So here's Kimmy again, okay?
When I first got here, I said to myself, am I really going and milking a goat? Like, is that really what I'm doing? And now I was checking my phone. I'm like, am I really caring about, like, what Lauren is doing right now when she's like, oh, what's up? Not much, just chilling. Like, is that really a text that needs to be responded to right away?
Wait a minute. You can't milk a goat on a Samsung Galaxy?
No.
Whoa.
I know, crazy,
right?
Learn
something
right?
on this
but,
show.
I mean, so this girl is saying, like, am I wasting my time texting about nothing? That's a triumph right there.
Kids are learning, apparently, at this camp that their identity is not determined by them with these electronic devices, but the devices are imposing an identity on them, and they felt free at camp without the devices.
I think that that's true. But what Matt Smith is saying, like, is that's not reality, right? You can't just not have a gadget all the time. So we need to give these kids coping mechanisms instead of giving them a digital blackout for the summer.
Manoush, before we go, because we will probably get about 17 billion requests for the name of this camp.
Oh, yes. Long Acre Leadership Camp. And they call each other farmers and they milk goats, and they can also be on their smartphones.
Manoush Zamarodi, our smartest phone, host of WNYC's New Tech City and fill-in host for this program. Thanks, Manoush.
Thanks, John.
So back to this issue of privacy once again. There may be more oversight on people reporting on the NSA and government surveillance than there is on the government watchers themselves. Evidence of that comes from the UK. Glenn Greenwald, the Guardian reporter who broke the Edward Snowden classified document story and published his leaks, found that his domestic partner was held for nearly 9 hours under British anti-terror legislation at Heathrow Airport. David Miranda, the partner of Guardian reporter Glenn Greenwald, was held under a controversial anti-terrorism law. Mr. Miranda's cell phone, laptops, and memory sticks were confiscated. David Anderson is the UK's independent reviewer of terrorism legislation. He joins us now. Mr. Anderson, welcome.
Thank you.
So is this an appropriate detention in your view? And just describe your position as an independent reviewer here.
I'm a lawyer who is appointed to read the secret stuff. I have the security clearance to do that and then report to our government and to our parliament on whether our terrorist laws are being operated as they should be. Was this an appropriate exercise of the power? I can't get into that today, but what I can say is that it was a very unusual exercise of the power. We have 200 million people a year traveling through our ports and airports in the UK. About 60,000 of those are stopped and examined under the Terrorism Act, and there are some very strong powers the police have in order to do that. And of those 60,000, fewer than 40 are kept for longer than 6 hours. That's in a whole year. So to be kept for 9 hours, as Mr. Miranda was, is highly unusual, and I'm going to be looking further into this.
And the reports from Mr. Gelman, principally, that Mr. Miranda was asked questions about who he'd heard about people talking to, other reporters, how reports were prepared, that sort of thing. It wasn't as though Mr. Miranda was suspected of being an actual terrorist. That's a little disturbing, at least in terms of the rule book by which these investigators can seem to go their own way.
Well, this is an old power, and by modern standards, it's a very extensive power. It can be exercised without the need for any suspicion or belief on the part of the police that a person is a terrorist. But the only purpose for which somebody can be legitimately questioned is in order to determine whether they are a terrorist. And, of course, while asking those questions, there can be all sorts of useful benefits in terms of intelligence and so on. But if you are not asking questions in order to determine whether somebody is a terrorist, then you're not using this power properly.
So, in theory, the UK government could be in some trouble unless it can prove that it was actually looking at Mr. Miranda as a terrorist.
Well, we're almost as litigious over here as you are in New York, and I'm aware of 5 cases in which the exercise of this power or even the existence of this power is being challenged in our courts. We also have a bill going through Parliament, partly in response to recommendations that I made last year, in which Parliament is seeking to review the power and knock some of the rough edges off it. I'm hoping that come the fall, when Parliament gets down to debating this seriously, it's going to have a good look at whether this bill goes far enough or whether they might need to do a little more.
I wonder if you could quickly respond to something that was said on the program earlier, and that is that single individuals such as yourself or small agencies overseeing these giant government surveillance operations are simply overmatched. They can do what they want, even though you're there, and I'm assuming you're a pretty sincere fellow, but you're just overmatched.
Yeah, that's something I'm always conscious of, but I have two great weapons. One is Parliament, one is the media. If they're not showing me stuff, if they're covering things up, I can say so, and they take the consequences.
David Anderson, the UK's independent reviewer of terrorism legislation. You wouldn't want to get on his bad side, that's for sure. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Look at the calendar, folks. We're counting down the days until school starts.
I am committing to our students, our parents, our citizens today that schools are going to open on time and safely.
But that countdown is a real cliffhanger in the city of Philadelphia, where Mayor Michael Nutter says he has the funds to open schools despite a huge budget shortfall and a court order that the city must find $50 million to hire enough staff to bring the students back. It's a very tough problem, and here to explain it is education reporter for our affiliate station, WHYY in Philadelphia, Kevin McCrory. Kevin, welcome.
Hi, John. How you doing?
Great. So explain what it is that sort of rules over the school system there in Philly. They have to have a certain number of employees to open that's motivated this whole unique plan to get the schools operating.
Right, John. So about 11 days ago, the superintendent of the district said the current status was not going to cut it. Essentially, schools were potentially going to open with just a principal and a secretary, no assistant principals, no other aides to help supervise the children. He said, that won't do unless I get $50 million, unless the district gets $50 million by Friday the 16th, schools will not open. So essentially, that $50 million has come through, and Superintendent Height said, okay, I will make sure schools open on time on September 9th. And essentially what that $50 million will enable him to do is to rehire 1,000 of the 3,800 district employees that were laid off in June.
So who's happiest here, the gym teachers, the guidance counselors?
So pretty much at this point, no one's happy, John. The 1,000 employees gets us back to what Superintendent Height has described as a functional level. Nowhere near even what it was last year at this point. And there's plenty of people out there, teachers, parents, students, who are rallying around this idea that even though we have $50 million, even though schools will open on time, what level of education are we providing? What level of safety are we providing? We can hear from guidance counselor Ruth Garcia, who was laid off from Edison High School in June. You know, she kind of speaks to the idea that, yeah, some staff are being hired back, but not even to the point that there's going to be a guidance counselor in every school.
All schools need school counselors for our children and our schools. What will happen if someone comes in and needs to speak to someone and there's not someone there?
So how are they actually calculating who gets hired back? What of this money has to be paid back? Does this put the school in a worse fiscal situation?
You know, one of the things that needs to be remembered here is, A, that there's a $304 million budget gap. This $50 million is just a small part of that. And there's a lot of other hodgepodging of money yet to be determined. We'll see how that comes through. But I think we can hear from Donna Cooper, who used to be in the previous governor's administration. And she can speak to the idea that, you know, this is going to be a perpetual problem until things get, you know, more shored up on the state level for how funding comes through to all districts in Pennsylvania.
Remember, we are all in this room mad at each other because $1 billion was cut from the state education budget and because the state laws that oversee this district have caused it to have no control over costs associated with charter enrollment and pension increases.
So the state funds the localities, and denials of state funding have really led us here.
Right, John. And, you know, one of the things that people are kind of pointing at the most at this point is that Pennsylvania is just one of three states in the entire country that doesn't have a funding formula that bases its education funding on the number of students in a district and special education. And that, you know, the cuts that Donna Cooper just described right there, you know, they were statewide cuts, but they hurt the poorest districts in the state the most.
So 2 weeks until school begins, this is far from over, and it's going to continue well into the academic year.
This is going to continue. Like we said, the $50 million is assured, but we still don't know where that's going to come from. And we're all just going to have to hold our breath and wait to see how that money comes through.
Kevin McCrory, WHYY education reporter on the plan to reopen Philadelphia schools in about 25 days. Kevin, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
There's a change going on in the way you vote. All across America, there's a new enthusiasm for altering the process for registration, the criteria for voting, even the days and times when people can legally cast their ballots. It's all due to the Supreme Court decision this year to strike down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act that kept certain places in America under the close scrutiny of the Department of Justice. This week, while you may be touring the national parks and forests, we're going to take you on a tour of the voting booths of America. We'll look at changes in Florida, where an effort to screen and remove non-USA citizens from the voter rolls appears ready to resume. We'll turn to Texas, where state lawmakers are redrawing their maps, and to North Carolina, where a longing for voter IDs will now be free of challenges and is changing how and when people can vote. The new reality for voting rights is the consequence of the so-called Section 5 preclearance requirement. That's what the Supreme Court struck down. It applied to certain states and localities based on their history. But why wasn't federal oversight over voting rights national and uniform? Gary May is a professor of history at the University of Delaware and the author of Bending Toward Justice, the Voting Rights Act and the Transformation of American Democracy. He says in some ways the seeds of our current voting controversies were planted in the politics of the original Voting Rights Act.
It became the position of those who actually opposed the Preclearance Act, because it was felt that by applying it nationally, it would place such a burden on the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, which then had a fairly modest staff and budget, that it would make the act ineffective. So both those who wanted the act to be effective and those who opposed the act later actually considered that seriously, but the Justice Department people rejected it while the critics pushed it.
Isn't it ironic that today the Justice Department, with Eric Holder at the helm, is anxious to show that it can do the kind of national oversight, precisely what was rejected by the Justice Department two generations ago?
Yes, I think the budget may be bigger, and I think that the Attorney General has a very strong commitment to restoring the Voting Rights Act and using the various provisions that we have left.
Is there a way to create a national preclearance now, or is that impossible? And what is the possibility within Congress of reconsidering the selective jurisdiction strategy that made the Voting Rights Act so successful?
I think it is possible to nationalize the Voting Rights Act. In fact, it already exists. The Section 3 of the Voting Rights Act, which the Supreme Court did not touch on June 25th, allows for what they call a bailing in of states where discrimination has been found. And what happens is a plaintiff goes before a federal judge and requests that this state be bailed in. The problem with Section 3, which is, again, now being used by the Justice Department, is that it's very difficult. The litigation involved requires that the plaintiff demonstrate that those who are interfering with voting had a clear intent to discriminate, whereas with the old Section 5, all one had to demonstrate was that the consequence of a change in voting practices affected African Americans or other minority rights.
Remind us of the gauntlet that an African American, an unregistered African American in the preclearance districts of 1962 would have had to go through to actually make it to the polls and vote for a Lyndon Johnson or a Richard Nixon or even a Barry Goldwater.
It was very difficult. First, they had to fill out a personal application about their background, their name, address, employer, so on and so forth. And if they made the slightest error, they would be immediately rejected. Then a long test followed, which required them to do a number of things. White applicants could simply copy a section of the Alabama State Constitution. African Americans, however, had that section dictated to them, which made it extremely difficult. White applicants had to copy a simple one-sentence section of the Alabama State Constitution and interpret it. African American applicants, as I say, had to take it down like stenographers, and it was a very long, complicated passage. Then there were questions that I suspect a Harvard PhD couldn't answer. How many bubbles are there in a bar of soap? Name all of the Alabama state judges. There were 67 of them in 1965. Well, let's say a miracle occurred and someone actually passed that test. If they did, their names and addresses were published in the local newspaper for 2 weeks, announcing to anyone who wanted to do them harm that they'd successfully registered to vote. And very often, people were fired from their positions because they had registered to vote. And among those who were especially reluctant even to try to register were Selma's teachers, because their jobs were dependent upon the sufferance of white school boards. So it was an impossible situation.
And if we are to take Chief Justice Roberts at his word that times have changed and that that gauntlet, in the way that you've described it, no longer exists, how confident are you that a new gauntlet won't replace it or isn't replacing it now in localities both within the preclearance districts and outside of it around the country?
Well, I somehow remain hopeful. If you know anything, again, about the history of the Voting Rights Act, about the people who risked everything, their jobs, their homes, even their lives, you know that this is simply not going to go away. I would hope that people would read the stories in this book, because not only is it dramatic, it is so inspiring to see what these people have done. And if they could show the same kind of commitment, courage, and persistence, we will turn this thing around.
Gary May is a professor of history at the University of Delaware, the author of Bending Toward Justice, the Voting Rights Act, and the Transformation of American Democracy. Professor May, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It was simply a campaign issue a year ago.
Eligible individuals who do not present a risk to national security or public safety will be able to request temporary relief from deportation proceedings and apply for work authorization.
President Obama announcing the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals Program, or DACA, an executive order seen as a way of improving turnout of Latino voters that would also give young people raised in America as undocumented immigrants the chance to be here legally, something Congress wasn't going to act on. Politically, the DACA program was successful for the Democratic ticket. It helped to reelect the president. But that did nothing to spur immigration reform still stalled in Congress right now. Yet in the years since the DACA program was enacted by a snap of the White House magic fingers, it has benefited perhaps a half million young people. Today, stories from two of them. 20-year-old Jaret Andreda came to the U.S. from Bolivia in 2001 and had spent more than a decade in limbo until about a year ago.
So I was actually about 2,000 miles away from home in California. I actually got on my email and I saw that there was they had forwarded me this memorandum of understanding. And it was Homeland Security was going to stop deporting students from 16 to 30, and it was called Deferred Action. And these students, like myself, would be able to get work permits and social security numbers, and that meant that some states would even give a driver's license. So I was moved to tears, but I was also, I had so many questions that day. It was something that we'll never forget. I think it was something that really changed our lives since last year.
And this really was a dream, the idea of a work permit and a driver's license, a social security number. I mean, these are the basic tools.
Yes, and even, you know, for the movie theaters, I remember going to watch Harry Potter and I didn't have an ID, so they didn't let me in. So things that people take for granted sometimes, like an ID, that's just something so basic to have proof of your identity, we weren't able to have because we did not have a social security number. So I was able to get my ID, and really when you have that, it's just so much easier to just go along and live a normal life.
Well, Jaret, how long have you been in the United States?
About 13 years now.
How has this changed your relationship with your parents? Because on some level, and we've talked with a lot of young people who really, you know, this whole predicament was the result of decisions your parents made. How has it changed your relationship with your parents?
Well, when I was 15, I think my mom set me down and she was like, I support everything that you do and you're a very smart girl and I support that you're going to college and that's one of your dreams, but I won't be able to afford it and you don't have a social security number. So I remember, I think that for that month when I was 15, I was just questioning, you know, why did you do this or how come, you know, were you not aware? I had all these questions, but I think that looking back, now I'm fighting for my parents because I realized that they had this dream of coming to America and it was to better the lives of my sisters and me. Now I am pushing for a reform that includes my family because I think that they deserve to work. They worked so hard over the past 13 years that, you know, now being without status is just terrible.
What if Americans view this whole situation as, all right, well, with deferred action, we solved that problem. There's really no need to extend it to the parents. That can all wait. We did something for the kids, and that's enough, and let's just move on. How would you feel about that?
I think that that sort of is saying, like, my parents are criminals or something, but they're actually the original dreamers. They came and they had a vision to make this country a better place and to be able to set roots in this country. You know, I just recently even posted a picture on my Facebook that about my dad, and he's an architect and he's very talented. And I remember him going to the Statue of Liberty for the first time and he just sort of stared at it because, like most architects, he was probably wondering, hey, I wonder if, you know, one day I'll be able to design something like this in this nation that is now my home. But he hasn't been able to do that, right, because he doesn't have papers. And so I think that undocumented families are just like all American families. I mean, they have dreams. And just even mentioning the Statue of Liberty, it's a symbol of hope, and it's a symbol of the values that this nation has that was built on immigrants. So my dad deserves an opportunity here.
Jaret Andrade is from Bolivia, currently a participant in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Let's welcome now 23-year-old Hina Navid, whose family is Pakistani. She was on a Pakistani passport when she moved to the United States from Dubai back in 2001. Hina, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
What did you think when you heard about the possibility of legal work residency in the United States because of the president's decision a year ago?
Initially, of course, it was a feeling of disbelief. After having no status for quite some time, it just seemed surprising that all of a sudden we would be able to have work permits just like that.
And so the papers that you never imagined having were suddenly available to you. How did you go about getting them and how has it changed your life?
We had to prove residency for 5 years and then we had to see a lawyer. And then they filed our paperwork. There was an application fee and then a fingerprint appointment. And then we received our approval 3 to 4 months later.
After all that time, did it amaze you how quickly everything changed?
Of course, definitely, because a major change in my life was I was able to apply to nursing school, which I previously was not able to due to lack of status. So, of course, it was a big shock. I got accepted into the nursing program, something I didn't imagine. I was able to get my first job, apply for my learner's permit, things that, of course, for so long had been out of reach.
How's that picture on your driver's license?
Yeah, not so great.
Not so great, right. How has this changed your relationship with your parents, who, of course, brought you here wanting the best for you, but suddenly maybe you have to fight for them now?
It definitely has made it more more real because now we know how it feels. I know how it feels to have the paperwork, and I would want my parents to experience the same joy, the same excitement, the same feeling of relief that comes with those documents.
Now you have what they want probably more than anything.
Exactly. We were hoping with the passage of immigration reform, something would happen that would allow our parents to receive the same documents or for all of us to receive a pathway to legalization. But that seems at a standstill now. So, of course, it's mixed emotions throughout.
And, you know, let's just take a look at what do you think is possible with immigration reform. There's still things that are barred to you, even given the fact that you qualify for the DREAM Act, the DACA program.
Yes, definitely. But of course, in order to gain something, we have to lose something. So we're hoping that the House of Representatives can do something better with the bill than the Senate did, because we have a lot of things that we gave up, so to speak, in the Senate version of the bill.
Are you a nurse today?
I'm not yet, but in 2 years, hope to be.
All right. She sounds like an immigration lawyer or a lobbyist at the very least, but she's actually studying to be a nurse, all because of the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that allowed her to work legally in the United States. Hina Naveed, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hina Naveed is one of the participants in that DACA program. We also heard from Jared Andrada, whose family came to the U.S. from Bolivia, too. Probably a 500,000 people who benefited from that year-old program. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the show, check us out at thetakeaway.org. You can always find us on facebook.com/thetakeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.